Pearson have printed out.
With the word lure.
Like, if they serve the cap, but he's not.
Oh, I saw.
I'm going around.
Not only does it say closet, it says closet for quotes. Closet for once it's made.
Closet for my.
What's the caliber?
I had the right number before. And I got up to get.
Closet or hair. Yeah, but I can see people thinking that they, like, I would never put my stuff in there unless somebody said, put your coat in this box.
I didn't want my coat anytime.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, I don't want to.
Not me, I brought my suitcase, moved around.
The bar.
Because even when they serve food, like, when I sit down with all the cookies, like, I'm scared to eat them because I don't know, like, make a mess or get crumbs or.
When you serve your cookies?
At one, not this one.
Oh, is it like an all day thing?
It was a board.
Was today an interview day?
Yesterday.
Oh, this is from yesterday.
This is from yesterday?
Yeah.
I was here yesterday. I thought it was pretty much eaten up, but.
Oh, no. I knew this would be here today.
But they didn't have any just turkey, right?
No, remember, it's like either turkey or roast beef or ham and bologna.
Yeah.
It's like, what if you just want
tuna? Right, or tuna.
I know.
If you're a tuna guy like me.
I just want to have a tuna.
Okay, so. Thank you all for coming to this rescheduled class. And I see you've already helped yourself. If I had known there was leftover food, I probably wouldn't have brought anything.
Oh, no, it was really good that you brought. Trust me, we'll eat. There won't be anything left. Or there will be, and we'll eat it all tomorrow, and we'll really continue.
I already bought stuff for tomorrow's class, so I'm one step ahead.
We're graduating.
How it's accumulating. Like, there's some puddings wandering around.
Oh, look at that.
Cheese sticks.
But you guys didn't like butterscotch too much, right?
Nothing goes to waste.
Nothing goes to waste. Okay. So, yeah, actually, tomorrow, I actually fulfilled someone else's fantasy that was on the list. It's a surprise.
Trip?
Yes. Someone said filet mignon, but that's not for tomorrow. I'm sorry.
That you don't want to fulfill. It's getting a little.
It gets a little pricey after a while.
Just a bit.
So, where we left off was attachment theory, and I just want to finish up that lecture. Tell me where we stopped. Does anybody remember exactly?
Secure kids with mental problems in the different areas of the world. People who are secure, people who are secure attachment.
Cross-cultural differences.
Cross-cultural. And then there was just a question. What about people who are secure that have mental problems? And you know, does it save you? No, but it can act as a buffer.
Well, then I have to talk really briefly again about associated disorders. So what disorders do different types of attachment mean?
Right, so I talked about that.
Yeah.
Okay. So people understand that in other cultures the same attachment patterns occur, but in different percentages. Everybody understands that. Any questions about cross-cultural differences or similarities to U.S. populations? Anybody have any questions about that?
I have a question. There are different attachment patterns in other countries. Are they correlated with the same mental illnesses that we looked at here, like borderline and all of that sort of stuff?
No, I don't know the answer to that question. That would be, I would assume so, but I can't assume that, can I? I don't know that those studies have been done. I mean, it's just recently if people try to correlate attachment with different kinds of psychopathology since the late 90s, that research did not exist before then because the tools to measure attachment, especially in adults, didn't exist until the late 80s, early 90s. So we're just now beginning to do that kind of research. And in child psychopathology, it's even more sparse. most of these earlier studies are being conducted with adults. People like me are the first people to try to apply attachment to child psychopathology and try to understand what the correlations are. So it's really not, you know, there's not a lot out there. But the question is, cross-culturally, would attachment patterns be related to the same kinds of psychopathology that they are related to here? I don't know the answer to that question. I would assume so, but I can't say that with certainty. Jessica.
You mentioned correlations of bulimia and anorexia, and I was just wondering if binge eating disorder had a correlation with anything.
No, binge eating disorder is not an official diagnosis in the DSM-4. It might come out in the DSM-5. So people are less likely to do really hardcore research on that diagnosis because it hasn't been officially recognized yet. So I don't think anyone has examined the relations between attachment, quality of attachment, and binge eating disorder, although I would think that the same pattern would apply, be a dismissing attachment, just like with bulimia and anorexia.
Okay, does that mean that it's kind of not up for grabs for future topics? Because it's not
no,
like
it doesn't.
An official DSM.
No, you can do that,
it?
Sure. Yeah. But you might want to refer to literature from other eating disorder
okay.
studies that suggest links to dismissing
okay.
attachment. Any other questions? I mean, I could ask, why do you think dismissing attachment would be more likely to be seen in northern German samples than in the United States, for example?
They're cold.
They're cold. Any Germans in the audience?
Okay.
So what are you saying, Pam?
I can understand like the German, being from the German culture, like that there's a certain amount of like you should be able to like do things for yourself. There's a certain amount of, I think, expecting children to grow up and sort of be like little adults, more so than I think in this culture.
Who read the Lion's Ruth article for today? Anybody? Rapprochement or approachement? Mahler's theory reconsidered from the vantage point of recent research on early attachment relationships. It's one of the greatest papers written in the psychoanalytic literature in the last 15 years. It's a very powerful paper, but she has she makes a statement about this that I want to read. Parenthetically, recent research studies suggest that there may be a cultural component to the emphasis in psychoanalytic theory on concepts of separation and autonomy. Okay. German investigators of early attachment relationships recently reported that almost half of the infants in a northern German sample displayed avoidant... This is research conducted by the Grossmans in northern Germany. They're very well-known attachment researchers in Germany. Almost half of the infants in a northern German sample displayed avoidant attachment patterns by their first birthdays, possibly related to the parents' systematic institution of culturally valued, quote, independence training, end quote, at 9 months of age. Thus, the general equation of early independent behavior with mental health and with the absence of spoiling may represent a residue of child-rearing values particularly prominent in certain segments of Germanic culture. By contrast, avoidant behavior is much less prevalent among samples of Japanese and Israeli infants, as well as American infants. So, what is she saying there? She's being very diplomatic and tactful. Now remember, she's writing an article about Margaret Mahler. Now, does anyone know where Margaret Mahler came from? She came from Vienna. And she, you know, escaped Germany when things started getting really rough and came to the United States and settled in New York. But she grew up in that Germanic culture. So someone here asked the question, does one's own child-rearing, who was it? One's own child-rearing affect their theoretical musings. Who was that? Was it you? Okay. I think Lion's Ruth is suggesting or implying that perhaps Margaret Mahler's own upbringing and her inculcation of, you know, Germanic cultural child-rearing values might have influenced her, you know, her very hard emphasis on separation and individuation as being the hallmark of a healthy toddler, infant/toddler. And Lyons Ruth is saying, well, wait a minute, maybe that is culturally biased, and maybe attachment theory can correct this bias, because attachment theory proposes that infants, toddlers, all the way up to adulthood, we all rely and depend, we need to rely and depend on others for our emotional security, that we always need a secure base from birth to death. So, you know, obviously that base changes over time. You know, late adolescence, early adulthood, it usually changes from a parent to a romantic figure. And that transition is always very interesting, but one always needs to a secure base to go to when you're feeling fatigued, tired, injured, afraid, you know, frightened by something. These are all moments when the attachment system becomes activated, and you reach out for somebody for support and help and love and comfort in a moment of distress. So Lyons Ruth is trying to you know, adjust for this, what she would describe as a bias in Mahler's theory, perhaps emanating from her own, from Mahler's Germanic origins. Does that make sense? And maybe if we had Margaret Mahler here, if we could bring her back from the dead, we could administer an adult attachment interview, and we might find out that she was dismissing attachment. And, but you see how it might have infiltrated into her theoretical work. Maureen.
I was going to say, I think it's interesting the fact that she, from what I read, it seems like she based her theory on her observations of like 23 infants. And were they all from Austria? So were they all from that culture that was very independent, human oriented?
Right.
That's skewed, so.
Well, Ainsworth, you're thinking 23 with Ainsworth. Ainsworth conducted her study in Baltimore with 23 infants, but Mahler conducted her study in New York City, actually, with 37 infants. But it's how you view these infants. Now, Lyons Ruth looked at these videotapes because they're still in existence. She re-reviewed them, and determined that what Mahler was looking at was not necessarily healthy separation, individuation from the mother, but rather perhaps disorganized attachment. These kids running away from their mothers upon reunion. She, you know, Mahler thought, oh, that's a normal phase. That's, you know, being afraid of being engulfed by the mother's, you know, omnipotence. And it's wanting to remain separate in the face of this very all-powerful, omnipotent mother that you could almost be sucked back into in a symbiotic relationship. And these toddlers are being very healthy by remaining autonomous and running away from the mother during this particular subphase of separation individuation, which we'll get into, these different subphases of separation individuation. So what Mahler viewed as being normal, Lyons Ruth is saying, no, that's not normal, that's kind of abnormal, and you know, it would fall under the category of maybe avoidant or even dismissing attachment. But Mahler didn't have the theoretical basis or the paradigm with which to assess the infants. These infants were assessed in a naturalistic playroom that Mahler had set up in New York City. But there was no system, it was not a systematic kind of paradigm to assess these kids for their separation and reunion episodes like Mary Ainsworth had developed. Ainsworth had developed this systematic paradigm that you could use for every single child, 8 episodes, 3 minutes apiece. And if you run every kid through the same paradigm, you're going to see differences, but they've all been subjected to exactly the same procedures. Mahler didn't do that. She wasn't a researcher. She was a psychoanalyst who had training in infant observation. and she had some very interesting observations, but she didn't, they weren't systematic. And that was her, it was a standardized kind of paradigm. She didn't have a standardized paradigm. We had to wait for Ainsworth to come along and provide us with that. Mahler didn't do that, and so that was her mistake, and that was what I would consider to be her downfall. She didn't standardize the situation in which she observed her infants. Also, it was only 37. It was a small sample. Now, you could argue that with Ainsworth as well, but many, many, many researchers have replicated Ainsworth's findings with much, much larger samples, and meta-analyses have also replicated Ainsworth's findings. So it's a pretty robust finding now, these four patterns of attachment. It's been done, as I said, cross-culturally, in other cultures, all over the world, same four patterns. That doesn't mean that a fifth pattern doesn't exist, but maybe we need somebody to identify it, but no one has yet. Because Mary Main came along when she identified the fourth pattern, the D pattern, and said, you know, there might be E, F, G, H, I, J, and K patterns. Well, you know, 17 years later, that hasn't happened since she published her paper 90. With Eric Hesse, that has not happened. So Mahler has been sharply criticized. This was the first paper to criticize Mahler from an attachment perspective. And, you know, basically ever since Mahler's star has been in, you know, waning, whereas Ainsworth's star has been, you know, waxing and waning. Okay, sort of, you know, ascendance versus descendance, maybe that helps. Any other questions about cross-cultural differences? And we'll get into Mahler's theory of separation and individuation in a little bit. All right. So let me just whip through the rest of this lecture. let's see. We talked about this, physiological control systems and the environmental control systems, failures in secure attachment. When attachment behavior is deactivated, Bowlby called that defensive exclusion, and that refers to avoided infants. They deactivate the attachment system, right? They act like nothing's going on except their heart is pounding. We talked about that, right, with the EKG leads, Alan Strofe of Minnesota. There's interference with loving and being loved because there's a fear of rejection, because they've experienced rejection so much by their caregiver. Caregiver, you know, does not want to touch them when the infant is seeking comfort as a result of an experience of distress. They internalize that, becomes a representation of an interaction that becomes generalized, rigs, I talked about that. And those rigs are what infants rely on to, you know, make their way through the world in interaction with other people. So false self or narcissism begins to develop. You know, they display one set of behaviors and emotions, but inside they're feeling something very different. So a kind of a schism begins to take shape and develop. Talked about this for the resistant infants, the C infants, the ambivalent infants. There's an inconsistency in the mother's availability and responsiveness. And this has been related in adult attachment to preoccupation with the mother and an intense anger. And BPD, borderline personality disorder, has been related to the C attachment pattern. In adults, it's referred to as E for entangled, but it's the same idea. And then Bowlby talked about the developmental pathways to clinical depression. There's a severe current adverse event, like a personal loss or disappointment. There's the absence of a companion in whom to confide. He studied a whole sample of depressed women, and he found these commonalities. Absence of a companion in whom to confide, difficult living conditions, loss of mother before the age of 11. And from an attachment perspective, losing the caregiver is a very, very serious insult to the whole psyche of a person, because your secure base, the one on whom you depend for security, feelings of comfort, relief of distress, is gone. So whom are you going to use to regulate your distressing emotions? It's nobody there. Maybe the father can act as a secondary source. But the, you know, the study that Bowlby conducted was in the, you know, 40s and 50s, before fathers really took a prominent role in caregiving. And then Alan Strofe, with his colleagues at the University of Minnesota, examined infants post-infancy in preschool and the early school years. And what he and his colleagues found was that avoidant infants tend to be aggressive toward peers. Now, he did this research without the benefit of the disorganized attachment. Remember, I told you that pattern came later in the history of attachment theory and research. Maine discovered that in 86 and published the guidelines for assessing disorganized attachment in 1990 with Judith Solomon. So a lot of these kids might have been disorganized as well, but Strofe categorized them as avoidant. And what he found was avoidant kids were very aggressive toward their peers. They were non-compliant in tasks that they were supposed to conduct with their mothers together. It's a puzzle sharing, puzzle completion task. The mothers, these are puzzle tasks that are just slightly more difficult than what a kid that particular age could solve. And so obviously the kid has to rely on the mother to help him with him or her with the puzzle. And what Strofe found was that avoidant infants tended to be non-compliant with the mother's direction. Like the mother said, well, why don't you try putting the puzzle here? No, I'm not going to do that. A lack of reliance on the mother for help. And of course, they were avoidant. The ambivalent infants, they were very, in the same puzzle task, very easily frustrated with the task, not persistent, didn't want to work very long on trying the task, and not very competent in completing the task. Secure infants, on the other hand, high persistence, high compliance with the mother, and high competence. They worked hard, longer, a lot of frustration tolerance, they were able to tolerate the frustration of the task, able to rely on the mother for help, and ultimately very confident in completing the task. And then finally, we'll just whip through this, the Dante Cicchetti article. Dante Cicchetti's at the University of Rochester. He had been at Harvard, didn't get tenure at Harvard like everybody else, and went to Rochester and conducted a lot of research on mentally retarded children, infants and toddlers, and PDD kids, and Down syndrome infants and toddlers. And what he found was that Down syndrome infants proceed through the same developmental sequences, but at a slower rate. The integration of what he calls the ecological self is difficult. The ecological self is the self that relates to other people in the world. A recognition of other people's affects and what that means and signals, and their ability to signal their own needs to others. That ecological self is difficult to integrate. Linguistic representations of the self are less mature and differentiated in Down syndrome infants. Ecological self is intact. They're able to perceive the nature of a relationship between the person and the environment, but the integration of this ecological self with all the other systems going on is very difficult. And then Cicchetti also examined maltreated infants. These are infants who were abused or neglected. We're talking about mostly physical abuse here, not sexual abuse. And what he found is that the maltreated infants actually develop the self differently, whereas Down syndrome infants develop normally but just at a slower pace, that maltreated infants actually develop the self differently. So for example, self-recognition, he conducted a mirror task where the infant is put in front of a mirror, and maltreated infants were able to recognize themselves, but it was accompanied by negative affect, shameful or bad feelings about oneself. Down syndrome infants don't say anything bad about themselves. They usually smile at themselves in the mirror. Maltreated infants don't smile at themselves in the mirror. They might even frown or say bad things when they look at themselves. The internal state language, the language that they use to talk to themselves when they're working through a task or whatever, less mature, less elaborated, less able to discuss internal states of self and other, less able to discuss negative internal states. Like, I'm feeling angry or I'm feeling sad, they don't have that capability. Okay, so we're done with that. And I want to show you some infants in a strange situation. But first I wanted just to go over some diagnoses with you. Make sure we get your dosage of the DSM. Mental retardation is commonly used in diagnosing children. One caveat is that mental retardation, it's a little known fact, mental retardation is the only diagnosis other than personality disorders that you place on AXIS 2. Don't ask me why. I don't know. But you place it on AXIS 2, not on AXIS 1. It's the only diagnosis other than the personality disorders that belong on AXIS 2. Okay? And you have mild, moderate, severe, and profound retardation.
Because it's considered to be fairly stable, like a personality disorder, like it's not going to kind of change from...
Well, you know, it's possible, but like dysthymic disorder is pretty stable, and that's on AXIS 1. You know, it's kind of like a low-grade baseline depression that doesn't really go away. It's kind of characterological.
AXIS 1 are the moneymakers, though.
AXIS 1 are the moneymakers. I never heard that before.
You bill for...
You mean like
those.
The...
You know?
Okay, you could bill for AXIS 2.
Yeah, but it's not as common.
But on AXIS 1, adjustment disorders go on AXIS 1, and many insurance companies won't pay for adjustment disorders. I don't know.
You label it as something different.
Huh?
So you label it as something different to get your money.
Generalized anxiety disorder. That's what I often do. So mental retardation, when you diagnose this, you have to remember, it's not only just IQ. What's the other aspect of mental retardation? You got it. Exactly. Social functioning, how they get along with others, the level of immaturity, that's also important in diagnosing mental retardation. So if they have one and not the other, you can't really diagnose it. All right. What else do we have here? Learning disorders. There are all different kinds of learning disorders. You just follow the criteria to see whether a kid meets those. You know, this program and most clinical programs don't really equip you to actually learn the compensatory strategies that are used for treating learning disorders. You usually farm those out to learning disorder specialists who, you know, have school psychology degrees, proper school psychology degrees, or something else like that. What?
We have improper school psychology.
No, remember at the beginning, at the very first lecture, I said that you could all apply for a school psychology certificate if you complete certain requirements along the way, like a school-based externship, a school-based internship, because you're already taking all the child courses you would need to apply for a school psychology certificate. So, like, I'm a school psychologist. I didn't go through a school psychology program, so... I wouldn't be considered a school psychologist proper. That's what I meant by that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. So there's reading disorder, mathematics disorder, there's a disorder of written expression. Those are the three primary learning disorders. And you're free to diagnose them, it's just that you're not going to get that well equipped to treat them unless you have some kind of special training or course. Okay? Then we go into motor skills disorder, like there's a developmental coordination. These are disorders that really aren't used that often. I've never diagnosed a child with developmental coordination disorder. But it's here. Huh?
Your
klutz. Right. The klutz disorder.
Nothing that 5 years of analysis won't fix.
That's right. Absolutely. This is marked delays in achieving motor milestones, dropping things, clumsiness, poor performance in sports, or poor handwriting. That pretty much covers all of us in here, I feel. Then there are the communication disorders. Anybody know the difference between expressive language and receptive language? Yeah. Tell me. Yeah. Today?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't need to go over that, but they're two different diagnoses. Expressive language disorder and receptive language disorder, and there's a mixed receptive expressive language disorder. I mean, these are usually disorders that are superseded by bigger things like PDD, you know, something massive. But they do have them here because there are children who just have a very focal deficit in one particular area, and so it'd be good to know how to diagnose them. Anybody familiar with the Peabody, the PPDT? You get exposure to that at all? No? Wow. It's really a cool instrument because it's so quick, and yet it gives a fairly accurate assessment of a child's receptive vocabulary. It actually goes into adulthood. You can also administer to adults. How it works is that you show four pictures on it's kind of a flip board. What do you call those?
Yeah,
a flip board? Is that what it's called? Right. It works like that, and it shows four pictures, and then you give the word, and you say point to the picture of the word. I mean, it's very simple, but it's extremely accurate, and it's very highly correlated with an IQ score, actually. But that's a way, that's a very quick and dirty way of measuring receptive vocabulary in kids. I used it for a research study that I did at Cornell and worked beautifully. Phonological disorder. People know what that is? Used to be called articulation disorder.
Can't say, literally you can't say your phonemes. You can't articulate the parts of words.
Exactly. Errors in sound production, use, representation, or organization, such as, but not limited to, substitutions of one sound for another. For example, use of T
for D.
Okay.
Would a lisp fall under that?
Yes, absolutely.
TD is a kind of T for D and P for D.
Right. Or omissions of sounds, such as final consonants. And the rule out is mental retardation. Okay, stuttering. Everybody know what that is? There are actually eight criteria for that. So you want to look that over. And then the pervasive developmental disorders. There's autistic disorder. A lot of people are familiar with that. Qualitative impairment in social interaction, as manifested by two of the following: marked impairment in the use of multiple nonverbal behaviors such as eye-to-eye gaze, facial expression, body postures, gestures to regulate social interaction, failure to develop peer relationships appropriate to developmental level, a lack of spontaneous seeking to share enjoyment, interests, or achievements with other people. The jargon for that is anhedonia. Anybody ever hear that term?
Pleasure.
Right. Lack of showing, bringing, or pointing out objects of interest. Lack of social or emotional reciprocity. Like if you smile, don't expect them to smile back necessarily. or if you frown, don't expect them to frown back. Chris.
How's that anhedonia, though? If they're off in their own little place and they're completely content, they're not being anhedonic. They're just... Like, in depression, it's where if you just, you know, things
you're
you normally would enjoy, you're not enjoying anymore. Like, a loss of pleasurable activities or pleasure from pleasurable activities. But I don't understand with, like, an autistic child, where, like, it seems, you know, if they're interested or they're engaged in something or some sort of, you know, like, stimulation, they continue to do it. They're just not sharing the attention with you.
Right, right.
So.
And it'd be anhedonia with respect to other people.
Okay.
Not across the board.
Okay.
Many autistic,
so
most autistic kids are not depressed at all.
Yeah.
It's how we define sort
exactly
of anhedonia, like what they should be interested in. Cause
exactly.
As a society, we think someone should be interested
exactly
in hand flapping and all that. So.
Exactly, exactly.
So
right. Marked impairment in the ability to initiate or sustain a conversation with others. Delay in or total lack of the development of spoken language. Now, this is not Asperger's now. We'll get to Asperger's in a minute.
How many are you looking for? Two?
Well, from the first four that I read, two from that,
okay.
But a total of six total.
Okay.
Yeah, that's under letter B. It's a very complex set of criteria. Stereotype, repetitive use of language, idiosyncratic language, lack of varied spontaneous make-believe play, or social imitative play appropriate to developmental level. So they're going to be very concrete. There's no kind of abstract thinking going on. Restricted, repetitive, and stereotype patterns of behavior, interests, and activities as manifested by at least one of the following: encompassing preoccupation with one or more stereotyped and restricted patterns of interest, maps, cars, you know, just one very important, or the weather, for example. I'm working with this Asperger's kid. He's 17, and he's fascinated with snow and winter. And
at all times of the year?
Yeah.
Could it be depressing like a for a lot of the year?
Well, I told him, why don't you get it? I'm trying to encourage him. Obviously, I'm not doing psychoanalysis with this guy. I'm trying to encourage him to develop some autonomy. So, because his parents are very intrusive, and he's actually trying to develop some distance from his parents. But encourage him to go to a drugstore, buy like a disposable camera, take a picture of the snow setting right outside in his backyard. And he didn't know that you could then take it and get a CD-ROM made of the pictures, even though he's a kind of a computer geek. He didn't know that. So yeah, you go in, you can get the CD-ROM made, and then download the picture that you took as wallpaper on your computer, and you'll have it year round. So he said he's going to do that, but we'll see.
There's a kid I'm seeing in the clinic who has Asperger's, and he's obsessed with telephones and attics.
Yeah. So it's just telephones and attics.
I've never heard that one.
It's
like
a house.
Not attic. Oh, attic.
Wait,
buses.
No.
Like,
yeah,
like an attic. Oh,
an attic.
As opposed to a basement.
Okay.
I'm from Chicago. I'm sorry. This happens all the time. Okay.
I knew what you. I heard you. I'm all the way over here.
So, yeah, but anytime, you know, you're talking or anything, do you have a house? Do you have a phone?
What's your attic like?
You know, do you have an attic? Is there a crawl space too? Like, who's doing what's up with you?
His favorite album is Toys in the Attic. Yeah.
Same story. I worked with one boy with Asperger's whose thing was futuristic animals. And it was...
Like a LIGO?
Yeah, exactly. And it was because he saw a special on one of those Discovery Animal Planet where they like combined animals, and that was all he would talk about.
Well, the Toyger is like coming out now.
The what?
There's something called the Toyger, and I guess it's like a tiger that was like crossbred with a domesticated cat, and it looks like a tiger. It's like very
Yeah.
Well, like,
Chris.
It's like a domesticated animal. Looks like a tiger. And it's like a small tiger, but it looks like a,
I've got it. There's a girl where I volunteer at the clinic, and it's Britney Spears. She has Asperger's, and Britney Spears is what? Yes.
Wait,
the
girl,
Michael
Jackson?
No, the girl at the clinic is obsessed with Britney. Like, that's what it.
That's
the fest. Like, we'll wander around, like, with lyrics to the song, singing them.
Did she take an umbrella to her
strange
husband's car?
Like, wandering around in the Hit Me Baby One More Time, like, outfits, and she's a very big girl, but to be wearing, like, the, I didn't get it with, like
early Britney Spears.
Yeah, like, I didn't get it, like, and I didn't understand why they were letting her, you know, like, dress this, and that's, you know, she's sitting in a room by herself, singing, and, you know, she's like, they just said, let her do her thing.
Well, there's plenty of people who don't have Asperger's who are just as obsessed with it.
Yeah.
I guess it's better to have those that are too
small. All right, so we got that. So, then there is Rett's disorder, which falls under PDD. Very rare. I've never diagnosed it. Rett's, R-E-T-T apostrophe S. Apparently normal prenatal, perinatal development, normal psychomotor development through the first 5 months, normal head circumference at birth, and then onset of all of the following after the period of normal development. Deceleration of head growth between ages 5 and 48 months. Loss of previously acquired purposeful hand skills between 5 and 30 months. Stereotyped hand movements, loss of social engagement early in the course, appearance of poorly coordinated gait or trunk movements, severely impaired expressive and receptive language development with severe psychomotor retardation.
So what does that look like?
Would you like me to act it out
charades,
for you?
Yes. Dr. Canafo used to do these for us.
Oh,
you know, we knew exactly what the histrionic personality looked like. So we need to know what Rett's looks like, Dr.
We
Goodman.
Had to do it.
Did we
wait, she had to act for that?
Syndrome?
I mean, oh.
She had
us.
We had to.
Did we skip Asperger's syndrome?
No, we're coming to
it.
Oh,
okay.
She's really all geared up for the Asperger's.
I really.
You ready for that?
I guess Rett's looks like autism, except like someone with autism, you can't tell by looking at them, whereas someone with Down syndrome or someone with Rett's, you might be able to tell from their face or certain
Well, from the criteria.
Stereotypical.
But yet, but also you'd have to ask about the history. This is why it's very important to collect.
But there could be a possibility in autism too. Like, kids can have words and then totally lose them.
That's why it'd be important to take a history, because when did they lose their words? Was it between ages 5 months and 48 months that they lost the ability to speak like that? So it's important to take a very careful history so that diagnosis is accurate. Why is that important? Because diagnosis leads into, you know, your formulation for a treatment plan. Childhood disintegrative disorder. Apparently normal development for at least the first 2 years after birth. Age-appropriate verbal, nonverbal communication, social relationships, play, adaptive behavior, and then clinically significant loss of previously acquired skills before age 10 in at least two of the following areas: expressive or receptive language, social skills or adaptive behavior, bowel or bladder control, play, motor skills.
Can you do a quote or something like that? God, as a parent, that could be able to jump out a window. That's hard. I mean, that's just like your kid's fine for 2 years and then your kid disintegrates.
Yeah,
so.
Right.
Could these possibly just be trauma-related disorders?
I think it could be.
I mean,
I'm looking here to see what they have to say, and because this is not my area of expertise.
I mean, because supposedly it wasn't made a actual diagnosis PTSD until recently, so then a lot of these disorders could have been
right. childhood disintegrative disorder must be differentiated from a dementia with onset during infancy or childhood. Dementia occurs as a consequence of the direct physiological effects of a general medical condition, for example, head trauma, whereas childhood disintegrative disorder typically occurs in the absence of an associated general medical condition. So it's acknowledged.